survived the 50-minute flight to the Irkutsk region while wearing only a light coat in temperatures of about 20 degrees below zero. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Gallagher in Moscow.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says welfare recipients there can no longer use state-issued debit cards at medical marijuana shops, tattoo parlors, and other businesses deemed inconsistent with the intent of the program. Back in June, Schwarzenegger barred the use of the cards, known as CalWORKS cards, at casino ATMs after the Los Angeles Times reported the cards were being used to withdraw cash at more than half of the casinos in California. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Independent Sector, working to lead, strengthen, and mobilize the nonprofit and philanthropic community at independentsector.org.
This year's elections may be among the most tumultuous in some time. The U.S. House and Senate, as well as the Illinois legislature and the governor's office, are up for grabs, with more competitive races and an unpredictable electorate. From Congress to Springfield to Champaign and surrounding counties, NPR and Illinois Public Media will bring you results and analysis all night, election night, beginning at 7. In-depth election coverage on WILL AM and FM. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. So tell me this. What associations come to mind when you hear the word cheap? Chances are, whatever they are probably negative. And our guest this morning, journalist Lauren Weber, says almost any way you look at it, the word cheap is an insult, particularly when that is applied to a person. But it was not always that way. This morning, in this hour of the program, we'll be talking a little bit about the history of frugality in America, perhaps try to get a better understanding of how it is that thrift went from being an asset to being a vice. And our guest for the program is Lauren Weber. She was formerly a staff reporter at Reuters and also at Newsday. She has also written for The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and other publications, and she is the author of the book In Cheap We Trust, the story of a misunderstood American virtue. It is now out in paperback. It's published by Back Bay Books, and if you'd like to read it, you can seek it out. And, of course, here as we talk on the program, questions, comments are welcome. We'd be happy to hear from folks. We hope people will be brief and try to stay on our topic. But, of course, questions and comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And Lauren Weber, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and you?
Good. Thanks good. For having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I think it's a good topic. I think particularly now it is a good topic as so many people are so concerned with making ends meet. And it's one of those times in American history when it being cheap starts to, you might want to say thrifty, but it starts to be a lot more critical and the kind of thing where people are actually maybe at the point where they're going to start bragging about their ability to pinch a penny.
It's true. You know, I think... One of the things this time period shows, and this came out a lot in my research, is that frugality, thrift, like most things we define as either virtues or vices, there's a very cyclical history to all of this. Our usual, or I think our, we might think that the history of America in terms of spending and saving is that we were once a thrifty nation and then we became profligate. But in fact, what I learned through my research is that, you know, this is a virtue that we've cycled in and out of throughout our history. And generally, whenever there's been a crisis, whether it's a recession or a depression like a recession that we're in right now, or a war that requires cutting back like World War II, where we had a lot of rationing, you know, generally when things are hard, when there's a crisis, this is one that comes back into style again.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point because I think that we like to think it's part of our national myth or these things that we assign to our personality that at least Americans are common sense people and they're not profligate spenders and that thrift, going back to Ben Franklin, maybe is one of the virtues that we try to practice. But the fact of the matter is that, and you pointed out in the book, is that, well, yes, there are times when Americans were very frugal, but it's because they had to be. And at those times when there was money or people had easy access to credit, then they spend.
Right. I always say thrift was a virtue Americans couldn't wait to relinquish. You know, we did. It was something that was admired in people, especially back in Ben Franklin's day. He made it very popular. Everybody wanted to emulate him. A lot of people looked up to him. But, you know, as you said, it was a virtue that was born more out of necessity. And anytime people had more money or, access to credit, whether that was installment plans in the 1850s to buy a sewing machine or credit cards in the 1950s, people generally took advantage and spent.
Just to something that we may, in fact, come back to, but, you know, one of the things that I think economists and others often lament is the low savings rate in the United States, at least compared to other countries. And they have looked at other countries. For example, Japan was always, for a long time, was famously held up as being this place where there was a very high rate of savings. And then people look at the United States and said, well, sort of what was wrong with us? Why weren't we saving? Mm-hmm. How much of that do you think does, in fact, have to do with access to credit?
Well, you know, like most things in that sort of explain human behavior or human history, it's very complex. And I think in America, maybe especially in a place like America, we get so many mixed messages about things. And we have so many warring impulses, both psychologically and culturally. You know, on the one hand, we're taught that saving money is good for us. It's kind of our Puritan heritage. It's good for the soul. It'll save us. And then it's also responsible. It's good for our own personal finances. But on the other hand, we're also taught that we should spend because there's something liberatory in spending. That's kind of a Freudian message that emerged in the United States in the 30s, and well, not so much in the 30s, but in the 40s and 50s, post-war era. And we're also told, you know, that this is fun. You know, it's good to have gratification and all that. And you know, so when you look at the low savings rate in this country, which it has been probably in the last decade somewhere around 2%, and that's much lower than it was in the 1980s when it was still around 10 or 11%. But, you know, it's really a problem, and I think that it's something that we've come to realize. You know, and the book deals a lot with the schizophrenic messages that we get around this. You know, on the one hand, economists right now are wringing their hands because consumers are not spending. They're nervous. They're worried about losing their jobs, so they're holding back. On the other hand, we also get the message that, you know, you've got to prepare for the future. And not long ago, Obama gave a radio address where he introduced all these initiatives to help to get people to save more money. So, you know, we're sort of caught between these very contradictory messages, and I think it's confusing for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I suppose some people, I'm sure, would point out the fact that particularly when we're talking about people, not people of means, but you're sort of your average individual, if you're trying to encourage them to save, the fact that most garden variety in savings vehicles pay interest that is next to nothing, and not only that, whatever you make, you have to pay tax on. Mm-hmm. If you ask this question now, are you really trying to encourage people to save? You know, what sort of incentives do people have?
Exactly, it's a disincentive to save if you're getting, you know, hardly even a penny on your dollar when you're putting in your bank account. But there are many kinds of ways to save money. Whether it may not be necessarily a savings account, it might be, you know, putting money into your 401k to prepare for retirement, that kind of thing. But you know, I do think we do need to create more incentives to give people a reason to save rather than to spend. The opposite. And it's the other side of the coin of those low interest rates is that it's very cheap to borrow money. And that was a big problem during the last decade or so. You know, you see how people borrowed for mortgages, took out home equity lines of credit. You know, you basically use their homes as ATM machines, and bought a lot of things that they couldn't afford, often with the kind of magical thinking that the economy was just going to keep getting better, housing prices were going to keep going up. You know, there just weren't a lot of people who were stopping and saying, like, hey, you know, things might not always keep going this well. You know, and this was encouraged at the highest levels by, you know, our Federal Reserve presidents and you know, chairmen and our politicians and legislators and stuff. So, and bankers certainly who were doling out this cash. So, you know, that magical thinking was encouraged at a lot of different levels.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you say is that you're trying to perhaps rehabilitate the word cheap, or at least encourage people to feel okay about describing themselves as cheap. One of the things I think is kind of interesting here from the word point of view is that if you go back and look at this word, at that word cheap, that if you go back far enough, you find that it meant something rather different than what it means now.
Yeah, it meant a good deal. That was the early English interpretation of the word cheap. You would say you got a good cheap, and it meant you got a good deal. And then sometime around the 1800s or so, it started to develop kind of a negative connotation for things that were poorly made or, you know, not worth their price, that kind of thing. But, you know, I kind of embrace the word because I think it captures some of the very complicated emotions we bring to these issues. You know, I start the book with an anecdote about an 87-year-old man who was a friend of my uncle's who heard about the book and really wanted me to interview him because he was...
Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
Waitress, I don't believe in that. And in fact, I used to be a waitress, so I always tip at least 20%. But, you know, I think that there's we should be looking at admiring the quality of somebody who's prudent or cautious with money or thinks about the future and, you know, maybe doesn't look to superficial things like spending a ton of money in order to, you know, create happiness or meaning in their lives. So.
Our guest in this hour is Lauren Weber. Her book is In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue. It is now out in paper. For those of you who were too cheap to buy it when it was in a hardcover, she's formerly a staff reporter at Reuters and Newsday. She's also written for New York Times and LA Times. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And here you talk in the book. Early on, I think actually you dedicate the book to your dad, who was one of these guys. He was the guy who was always going through the house turning off the lights. He's the guy who, when you complain about being cold in the house in the wintertime, he says, go put on a sweater, and which seems pretty much to be a dad thing. I don't think we get, I don't know, maybe you've heard stories from people saying, oh, yeah, actually my mother was the one who did that. But it seems to be kind of a guy thing, and probably in every family, or many families, somebody's going to say, oh, yeah, I know that guy. I lived with that guy.
Yeah, I do occasionally hear stories about moms and lots of stories about grandmothers, of course. You know, many people have grandparents who were alive during the Depression and, you know, saved every single scrap of everything. I heard one story about a grandmother who would take ice cubes out of her guests' glasses when they were done and put them back in the freezer. but, you know, I have to say, I think you're probably right. I am more frequently told that it's the fathers. And my dad is certainly the inspiration for the book. He was an economics professor for about 35 years, so he's an economist in every sense of the word, professionally and in his personal life. And I grew up in New England in Connecticut, and it was cold there, and my dad kept the heat at 50 degrees. And, you know, like you said, if you complained that you were cold, he'd say put on another sweater. I used to do my homework with my hands on the stove and my feet on the radiator and wearing a hat and a scarf just to try to stay warm. And my mom often tells the story about how she once threatened to pack up my brother and sister and I and bring us all to a motel unless my dad agreed to turn up the heat. And at that point, I think he realized the hotel would actually be more expensive than just, you know, turning the heat up from 50 degrees to 55 degrees, which at that point probably felt practically tropical. But yeah, he once tried to ration toilet paper in our house. He likes to use hand signals out the window of his car rather than his turning lights because he doesn't want to wear out the bulbs. I mean, there's just story after story. And I grew up complaining bitterly about this and probably even leaving lights on just to make my father angry. But at a certain point, probably when I got older and started to support myself, I came to realize that, you know, he was onto something. You know, first of all, I realized that he wasn't just you know, cheap in a sort of negative sense, he had his values straight, you know, and I think that's really what it was about. He might have been crazy, you know, gotten crazy if I was in the shower for longer than 3 minutes. He'd knock on the door and yell at me to get out. But, you know, when it came time to go to college, my brother and sister and I all went to very good schools. My parents paid for private educations without a word of complaint. My dad gives a lot of money to charity, and, you know, he'll give money to anybody he knows who needs it. You know, he's a very, very generous man, and yet it coexists with this, you know, sort of penny-pinching side. And I just came to realize that at a certain point he just knew what his priorities were, and I came to admire and respect the way he was and also feel grateful for the lessons he taught me.
That's, I think that that's important to acknowledge that for so many people, that this is aligned with their personal values, and it's not just saving a penny for a penny's sake. We're not talking about Scrooge, a kind of a Scrooge character here. We are talking about people who would say, no, see, I think it's really important, and for this reason, and they're concerned about waste. Or now I think probably more and more there are people who are concerned about their environmental footprint, you know, how it is that they live and what that means for the earth. And that really is, I think for a lot of people at a deep level, it's about basic values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sort of not taking things for granted, I think. You know, we were always taught just to be very careful and to think ahead and prepare for a rainy day, I guess. You never know when that's going to happen. I think a lot of people are learning that the hard way right now with unemployment as high as it is and home foreclosures and things like that. So, you know, I think sometimes I'm a little bit mentally ill about these things. You know, like I can agonize about whether or not to buy a $5 sandwich, and, you know, I think most people would think that that's probably a waste of energy to agonize about that, and it probably is. But I also know that, you know, in the end, being frugal has bought me a lot of freedom to do the things I want, whether it's go to graduate school to become a journalist. You know, I took 2 years off to write this book and was able to support myself with my advance from my publisher, but also my savings, you know, and living extremely cheaply, more cheaply than I ever had. I started making my own laundry detergent at home. But, you know, I'm glad that I have those skills, and I think we should be making more of an effort to teach those to other people.
Yeah. Well, and I think probably the more you get into it, I think you discovered that, in fact, there are a lot of people that have this orientation, that it goes a little contrary to what perhaps we think. I think in the book you talk about the fact that when you started working on it, a friend of yours said, well, you should call the book Thrift, A Short History of a Dying Virtue. And that once you got into it, though, you started to realize, well, actually, it maybe isn't a dying virtue.
No, not at all. And that was one of the best surprises of writing the book. You know, like you said, my friend said I should call it Thrift, A Short History of a Dying Virtue. But every time I would mention my research to anybody, you know, a stranger, a friend, an acquaintance, they would say, oh, you should interview my husband, you should interview my boss, you should interview my daughter, you should interview my grandmother, you should interview me. You know, it was clear that lots and lots of people were living cheaply or living frugally. It's just that they kind of had gone underground. You know, and getting back to the history here, this was once a widely admired American virtue. We considered it a real part of our national character and national identity. And then, you know, and I sort of date this to about the post-war era, we started to look on consumerism as more, and spending as more of an identifier of the American character. You know, that was the time when spending money became kind of a patriotic duty. It was actually politicians and economists after World War II were very worried about slipping into another depression once the stimulus of the war spending was gone. Now, that was a legitimate concern. I mean, the depression was a traumatic event for millions of people. So there was almost a concerted campaign. You look at the advertisements from that era, and it says, you know, buy these velvet curtains for your home because it'll keep Americans at work. You know, the patriotic duty to keep spending was very strong. And it still amazes me how much we've internalized that message. When I was working as a reporter at Newsday, I covered retail, and I was constantly ambushing shoppers while they were at the mall and, you know, asking them what they were buying and why. And it amazed me how often people would say, you know, sort of laugh sheepishly and say, well, I'm doing my part to help the economy. So, you know, we've really internalized this idea that to cut up your credit cards would somehow be unpatriotic.
We have a caller here at someone who's listening online, obviously, because they're in San Francisco. So let's go there on to our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hey, morning.
Hi.
I took economics and financial management back in the late 80s, and as we were doing it, we were trying to calculate what an honest minimum wage was. And that had the course had been just about 20 years after 1968. So we were looking at February of 1968 as the starting point, and that would have been the year when the baby boomers really pretty much started to hit the market. So in February 1st of 1968, the minimum wage was kicked in at $1.60 an hour, and at that time, gold was $35 an ounce. So it would take a person 22 hours at minimum wage to buy 1 ounce of gold. So if you extrapolated that today, I think gold is, what, about, $1,300 an ounce? It would take you about $57 an hour. You're dividing the current price of gold by 22. The minimum wage should be about $57 an hour. And, you know, obviously a plumber should get 4 or 5 times minimum wage, maybe 10 times if they're doing high-tech work. Doctors should get a certain amount higher than the minimum wage, you know, factors of. So I'm just wondering if your guest has got some sort of other equation that would show what the honest minimum wage should be, and then this whole issue of being skinflints or real honest spenders would then have some more focus.
Well, I don't have a calculation like that one on minimum wage, but it reminds me of the argument that's often been made by Elizabeth Warren, who was recently nominated by President Obama to be the head of the new Consumer Financial Board to sort of look out for the interests of consumers in financial issues. And she pioneered this line of interest, line of research that basically said, you know, many people over time have said, oh, Americans are overspenders, and my book makes that argument in some ways. And she says, well, it's not so much that a lot of the debts that we're in come from we're buying too many flat-screen TVs or too many extra homes or things like that. She says the problem is that Americans' wages haven't kept up with the increase in costs for education, healthcare, housing, and these kinds of basic items. And it's a very, very convincing line of argument. You know, she's right. There's, you know, in my book, sort of in talking about or saying that people, should try to be more frugal, that it would give us a little bit more peace of mind and all that, I also try to address some of the bigger issues, macroeconomic questions about, you know, the fact that wages really have not kept pace with inflation, certainly not in the last decade or so. You know, there are bigger systemic issues that we need to address, and that is making sure that people have good jobs with decent pay and, you know, are able to afford the kinds of things that they need, like education and health care and housing. But on the other hand, you look at it, and that argument also has to be tempered with the fact that at the same time as prices for those things were going up, Americans were also spending more money on entertainment, pets, you know, things that were not really necessities. So there's a combination of big picture issues going on, and then also I think a bit of a lack of discipline or a loss of that basic respect for the virtue of frugality.
Did it, caller, just want to make a quick follow-up?
Well, I agree, although I just wanted to raise the issue of if you looked at the standard of living that we had back then, you know, obviously we've got a whole lot of cheap trinkets that are on the market, and they kind of keep people satisfied with cheap quality. And, you know, in a sort of prima facie way, they, in other words, antiques and other high-quality items that might last for, you know, 500 years are essentially tossed into the curb at you know, annual clean-out day. And so we don't necessarily use things for decades or longer anymore. We essentially throw away houses. We throw away cars. And so this whole idea of being able to use a product for decades with comfort or with confidence instead of constantly being told that, you know, we're not up to date if we keep the same kitchen chair for 40 years.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And there is, you know, we live in a disposable instant gratification culture. And, you know, when I talk about, when I use the word cheap and embrace it, I'm not saying that we should be buying more cheap stuff. You know, it's more, my thinking is that we should be just buying less stuff. You know, it's not about going to Walmart and loading up on extra DVDs and, like you said, trinkets. And, in fact, there's a great quote that I use in the book by the poet and environmentalist Wendell Berry. He says, we should be more materialistic. We should be taking care of our materials. You know, he says basically what you've just said, that, you know, a truly materialistic in the real and perhaps good sense of that word is a culture that takes care of its things. And that is something we've lost in, you know, the mass production, mass consumption society that we live in.
I want to thank the caller. We are just about at our midpoint of this hour of Focus. Our guest is Lauren Weber. She's formerly a staff reporter at Reuters and Newsday. She's also written for the New York Times, the LA Times, other publications, and she is the author of the book, In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue, published now in paper by Back Bay Books. Came out in hardcover about a year ago and is now out in paper. If you want to read it, go out to the bookstore and look for it, or go to the library and look for it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Probably the man who is the patron saint in a secular sort of way of thrift in America probably is Ben Franklin, since he's the one who popularly espoused these kinds of values, and other of the men of his generation did too. Although when you look at how they actually live their lives, and actually maybe if you look at how a lot of people live their lives, you have to question just how deep that runs and how serious they were about it.
Absolutely. You know, and that's a theme that kept popping up. You know, Ben Franklin often talked a good game. He didn't always live by his own values. You know, he was famous for, when he was living in France, he was sending home chests full of damask curtains for his house in Philadelphia, and he loved good food, good wine. You know, he was definitely a lover of life. But that also made him an interesting character to write about, and that's kind of what makes people tick in general. So over the course of writing the book, I became more forgiving of seeing that both in the characters I was writing about and also in myself. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily hold myself up as a paragon of frugality, although I think, you know, most people looking at the way I live would say that I'm extremely frugal, and I am. But, you know, I think that those contradictions in people are very interesting. I'll walk, you know, 30 blocks to save $2.25 on the subway here, but I'm wearing my $350 Italian leather boots. So, you know, but I have to say that those boots, I take very good care of them, and they last me 4 or 5 years, so it amortizes to about $70 or $80 a year, and I feel like that's still a pretty good deal. But you're right, you know, there is, you know, it's similar both in individuals to the culture at large. We may admire certain qualities, we don't always live by them. And as time went on, even Ben Franklin became somebody who people might have looked up to for his folksy wisdom and his common sense. But, you know, even so, as they rarely took his advice. One of his most famous pieces of writing was The Way to Wealth, which was a parable about a man at a marketplace, and people ask him, you know, say to him, the economy is terrible. What should we do about this? And he says, well, the secret is hard work and thrift. And he writes at the very end that people listened, they nodded their heads, they went into the market and immediately spent all their money. So, you know, people often know what might be right for them, but they don't, you know, we have like these warring impulses, and it's sometimes hard to live according to the values that you espouse or that you think might do best.
Even the Puritans, apparently, once they got here and they got established and they started doing well and they started having some disposable income, they decided they wanted to have nice stuff.
Yes, and that was so interesting to me. And another one of the surprises while doing my research was that, you know, this ambivalence that I think we feel today about spending and saving and not being quite sure what we should do, it was there, you know, for the Puritans in the 1600s and the 1700s. It's been there at every era of American history. And, you know, Puritan leaders actually passed sumptuary laws because they were so distressed to see people spending money. You know, they had a kind of salvation religious attitude about this, that if you were focused on worldly goods, you obviously weren't focused enough on saving your own soul. So they passed these laws that basically said you could only have two buttons on your jacket, not three buttons. Your buttons couldn't be gold or silver. They could only be copper or, you know, steel. You know, they really tried to restrict the way people spent their money. And it was difficult because it was a religion that, you know, this is a Calvinism behind it, that promoted hard work and thrift. And so what happens when you get hard work and thrift together? You end up saving a lot of money. So the Puritans had, many of them were, or some of them were very wealthy, and they had come to this land of abundance. And it turned out to be an untenable problem. One historian called it the paradox of prosperity and piety. You know, they might have said that they believed in modesty and frugality and thrift, but yet the money was piling up in their storerooms, and eventually people wanted to spend it.
We are fascinated with, well, generally speaking, I should say we're fascinated with wealthy people and how they live and what they have. So that's really clear. But it's also interesting that over time people have been fascinated with the other kind of character. And in some cases, these were people who actually had money but lived as if they didn't. And I guess one of the really fascinating people here that I never heard of, and probably a lot of people didn't, is Hetty Green. Tell us about Hetty Green.
Yeah, she's a great character. She was born in the late 1800s into a whaling family in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and inherited some money from her father. I think she was an only child, so even though she was a girl, she inherited this money and also was kind of taught family business by her parents. And she ended up becoming one of the wealthiest investors and industrialists of the early 20th century. And yet she was named by Guinness as the world's biggest miser after her death. She was known for living in unheated tenements. She lived in the New York area. She was known for living in unheated tenement buildings in Brooklyn and Hoboken. She would move apparently every few months because she didn't want to pay her rent. And then she would come to her office at a bank. She got like a desk at a big bank down on Wall Street, where she had a lot of her accounts. They just gave her a desk in a corner somewhere, and she would bring her oatmeal for lunch because she didn't want to have to go to restaurants every day. She'd bring her oatmeal in a pail, and she would heat it up on the radiator. So, you know, some of these stories might be apocryphal, but she was quite notorious, and people were fascinated by her. Journalists would try to chase her down to do stories on her. And yet she was also, in this part of the story, wasn't as widely told, although later it was by her biographer. She was also fairly generous, gave a lot of money to charity, and had a lot of common sense when you actually sat and listened to or read some of the interviews that she had done. There was such a fascination with her, and partly because she was such a contrast to what else was going on in the Gilded Age of that time, where people were also reading stories about some of the robber barons who every day would eat a pound of caviar mashed into their mashed potatoes.
That doesn't sound appealing to me.
No. Well, you know, and I think it's similar today when I tell people the stories about my father. There's such a fascination with his kind of compulsive brand of cheapness. And also, you know, other contemporary examples. I write a lot in the book about communities of people who have kind of disavowed consumerism today. And one of them is a group called Freegans, and they're anarchist, anti-capitalist, pro-human rights, pro-animal rights, agrarian pacifists. And there's a big community of them living in New York, and they basically say that they don't want to live in the money economy. So they tend not to have jobs. They dumpster dive for their food and belongings. They might squat in buildings. They ride their bikes or walk everywhere. And there's such a fascination with these folks. They were actually on Oprah about a year ago. And I think it's sort of similar to the way people looked at Hetty Green.
Yeah. Well, that, I suppose, gets to the story about, again, gets back to questions about deep motivation. And you would look at somebody like your dad or those people, or the people who are listening to us can pick the person in their life that they think of. And you might applaud them for their thrift. You might applaud them for the fact that they have some real basic set of principles that has to do with value and what value is, and that they try to live their life according to that. And you could say, well, that's all swell, but that sometimes it gets to the point where it starts to get into pathological territory. And so you sort of have to wonder, well, what's going on the deep psychological level?
Right. And I mean, that's probably one of the reasons I wrote this book, was because I've always been trying to understand my father and who he is and how he became who he is. And early on in the research, I asked my great aunt, my father's aunt, who's also a psychotherapist, I said to her, why is Dad so cheap? And she said, well, Freud would say it has something to do with unresolved potty training issues. And I said, that's ridiculous. And she said, well, it's all about what you hold on to and what you let go of. And I thought, wow, that actually makes some sense. My father disagreed with that notion. He doesn't think there was anything wrong with his potty training process. But, there we have tried, and I think most people who have lived with somebody who is as cheap as my father have tried to sort of understand where this impulse comes from. And there have been different explanations at different times. Nowadays, in contemporary psychological parlance, it's considered to be related to obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. And like most obsessive-compulsive disorders, it may have something to do with a sense of insecurity in the world, a feeling that you're obsessed with trying to gain some security, a fear of what's around the corner. And I see that, like I was talking earlier about saving for a rainy day, that can veer into being a little bit compulsive, just a constant sort of catastrophizing in your mind about all the things that could go wrong. But, there's some value to having to being able to think about worst-case scenarios. And I think that's one of the lessons from the current recession we're dealing with is it's not always sunny days ahead. Sometimes bad things happen and you have to be prepared for them. But, yes, it can get a little bit pathological when you're just kind of so anxious and so nervous about what's to come that you can't actually enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
And I think with a topic like this, it's easy to think it's all about self-denial and abstinence, and I don't believe in that at all. I mean, like I said, I wear my $350 boots and I love them. They were worth every penny. And I love to travel and I love to do, great things, things that I enjoy. But, it's really just about having a sense of balance. I don't think everybody needs to live the way I do. Getting back to that savings rate thing question, if everybody lived the way I did, it would be quite disastrous for the economy. I probably save about 25% of my income, unlike the average maybe 2 or 3% in the U.S. But so I'm not saying that everybody needs to live like me. It's more just about finding a balance, finding a way to live within our means. And that's good for us as individuals, and it's also good for us, as a broader economy.
So this then all that gets to a really interesting, though, again, sort of question that has to do with psychology, and that it's something to do with how it is that people think about the future, or whether they really think much about the future, and that there does seem to be some sort of basic kind of difference between people who are maximally frugal, who think about that, because they are either worried about, or maybe if not worried about, they're much more conscious of the future, and that maybe for people who don't think about those things, they're more anchored in the present.
Yeah, it's true, and we're always told live in the present, live in the moment, and I try to do that in my own life, but I also think there's value to every now and then thinking about the future. One of the most interesting conversations I had when I was working on my chapter about the psychology of cheapness was, well for one thing, it was very striking to me that researchers had actually looked into this question. We have tons of consumer researchers and marketing professors who look into why people buy. Almost nobody has investigated why people don't buy. So there's very little research out there about frugal people as a kind of psychological demographic. But I did have a conversation with one of the few people, a behavioral economist named Scott Rick, who studies a lot about frugality as a character trait. And he was saying that frugal people tend to feel that the future is closer. A week from now feels closer to me than it might to somebody else. And I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it. It just feels closer. It seemed very poetic.
Yeah. Lauren Weber is our guest. She is a formerly staff reporter at Reuters and Newsday. She is the author of a book that has recently come out now in paperback. The title of her book is In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue. It tries to take a look at how it is over time Americans have thought about thrift and about this way that we seem to cycle back and forth between thinking that it's a good thing and maybe not being quite so sure. And again, questions welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And there's another really interesting section in the book here that that looks at this question about the associations we have with cheapness and or thriftiness, you know, depending on what kind of word that you want to use, and about the fact that so often thrift, or probably more like stinginess, miserliness, thrift taken to the extreme, how this gets woven into ethnic stereotypes.
Yeah, I have a chapter called Cheap Jews and Thrifty Chinese, and that's those are the two groups that I looked at most for that. It becomes a very key part of various stereotypes, and each of those two groups that I mentioned have a very different history behind this, but often it speaks to a kind of anxiety or worry on the part of the, you know, in this case I was talking about the United States, on the part of Americans who had been living here before, that these were two communities that were very commercially successful, economically successful, for different reasons and with different histories behind them. But there was a lot of concern, you know, that Jews were coming in and taking jobs from Native Americans. I don't mean Indians, but people who had been living here before. And that these ethnic groups represented some kind of a threat to white Americans. And so, again, it's that way that cheap gets tossed around as a pejorative. Jews were often labeled cheap as a way to, I think, neutralize some of that competition or deal with some of the resentment or envy that came up as they came to the United States and were, you know, became more integrated here and more successful. And there's so many cheap Jewish jokes that I had to choose from. I ended up starting the book with a few different ones, it just amazed me how many were out there. It's such a salient part of the stereotype.
Let's talk with the caller here, Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned obsessive-compulsive disorder, and along the spectrum of cheapness, I wondered if you also looked into hoarding.
I did write a little bit about hoarding. You know, there's the famous case of the Collier brothers, who were two brothers who lived in Harlem. I believe they died in the 40s or 50s. They lived in a townhouse that, by the time police came to find their bodies, police could hardly get in. They found the chassis of an old car. They found like 8 grand pianos. Basically, the brothers would just go out every night sort of scrounging and scavenging and would save every little piece of trash that they could find. And it's a similar idea behind it of that insecurity and anxiety, you know, and I see this. You know, you do see it with cheap people. Maybe with cheap people, it has to do with money, feeling like you've got to have money around in order to. It's always just in case, you know, because who knows what kind of catastrophe is around the corner. But, it's the same thing whether it's saving a piece of string or saving a piece of money. It's this fear that you can't throw anything out just in case you need it, or, you know, you can't spend any money just in case you need it. And, you know, I said earlier that I sometimes agonize over buying a $5 sandwich, and it is that same idea that, well, what if I need that $5 later for something else, like a root canal operation or something?
Wow, you know where you can get a $5 root canal?
Well, you know, $5 of several thousand, it adds up. But all those foregone sandwiches eventually add up. Hoarding is definitely very, very connected to this. But with hoarding, of course, it's things more than money, but you often find it in the same people.
Well, I had heard that often hoarding has been triggered by a trauma.
I didn't investigate. I didn't go too deeply into it, but that makes sense to me. I mean, I think I have read things that, you know, somebody who loses a parent early on in life, you know, it's a feeling of needing to keep things close it becomes impossible to let go of anything, and perhaps that translates from being able to let go of human connections to being able to let go of things and stuff.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks. Thank you. And again, we have maybe about 6 minutes left on the show. Someone wants to call real quick. Lee, we can get them in. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Have there been times when government has really in a very decided, well, people really were spending too much, or maybe it's just that the government said, well, we really need to promote savings, and so we're going to try to do that in a really aggressive way. And did that ever work?
Yeah, I mean, government has tried to intervene in this issue at different times, and I think probably the most dramatic time was during World War II. It happened during World War I also, but during World War I, the efforts were voluntary. World War II, we had rationing, so government really stepped in and basically said to people, you know, you can't, you're going to get coupons for how much gasoline you can use, you're going to get coupons for sugar. You know, they really restricted consumption in a very kind of autocratic way. Although, you know, I would argue that it was probably necessary because we needed so many resources for the war effort. But they did the same thing at the time with money. You know, there were all these the campaigns to get people to buy war bonds, and there were, this is probably one of the side of the campaigns that rarely came out, but apparently there was tremendous pressure on people. If you were at a rally and you didn't sign up to buy a war bond, you could be branded you know, a traitor, you know, or unpatriotic, or that you were somehow supporting the Germans. There was a huge amount of pressure brought to bear on people, you know, to basically save their money and then use it to invest in war bonds. So government has stepped in at these different times. And, of course, as I was saying earlier, Puritan leaders passed those sumptuary laws to restrict people from spending their money. But, you know, I think governments have generally found that it's not that easy. You know, and even during the rationing of World War II, there was studies that were done that showed that 25% of Americans bought things on the black market. So, you know, this desire by people to make their lives more comfortable, more easy, you know, which I totally understand, you know, it often trumps what we might think of as our duty as a citizen or, you know, as a forward-thinking person, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller here over in Indiana. This is Cloverdale, Indiana, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I am probably one of the cheapest people I know, and I'll tell you what did it. Being a graduate student. I lived on $4,000 a year in Boston. Now, think about that.
Wow. I'm impressed.
I've just retired from industry. I have a doctorate. Okay? I'm still cheap.
What are your favorite ways to save money?
Buying things on sale. Buy things that actually cost more but last longer. For instance, Michelin tires. They cost a ton of money, but I get a lot of life out of them. Mm. So I'm not afraid to spend money, but I really work at making sure I get a good value. Also, I have one of the cheapest houses of any person in my whole department when I was there, but now I have got no problems with mortgage payments.
Well, that helps a lot. You know, often we think, oh, I should just cut out the latte every day. You know, you hear a lot, how do you save money? Well, stop going to Starbucks every day. But really, it's those bigger choices. It's making a choice to live in a smaller house rather than take on an enormous mortgage. You know, making a choice to be a single-car family rather than a two-car family, if it's at all possible. You know, those bigger decisions are really the ways that
on latte, though, we make really good food. We grind our own coffee because we get actually better coffee. You get what I mean? So, mm-hmm. And it's a better value and it's cheaper.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the call. That sounds like his Michelin tires and your fancy boots would be very happy
yeah.
together.
Well, you know, I bought them my $350 boots because I had been buying, you know, inexpensive boots for a few years. I live in New York, so I walk everywhere, you know, even in the winter and slush and rain and all that. And I just found that I was buying these boots for $50 or $60 and they'd fall apart, you know, within one season. So I finally said, look, you know, I'm just going to invest in quality and And I did, and you know, to me it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. We're coming down. I want to thank the last caller. We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. I'm sure that for people who lived during the Depression, that experience put a mark on them. It shaped the way they think about a lot of things, and that was something that lasted throughout their life. You know, and now we're going through some very difficult economic times. I mean, not quite as tough as that, but tough, and a lot of people are having a difficult time. And you sort of wonder, will that, for people who are living through that now, would that have the same effect on them and their character that the Depression did for the people who lived through that?
Well, you know, we're really not at the point, nor not nearly at the point that people were during the Depression when unemployment was at about 25%. You know, people were really just barely scratching out a living. I mean, there are people, unfortunately, who are in that situation now, but not nearly as widespread. So, you know, I think that I wouldn't be surprised. One thing that reading up on the history of this taught me is that, you know, generally people are very good at tightening their belts when they have to. We're very flexible and adaptable and resilient people. But generally, as soon as the economy comes back, as soon as the good times return, we have very short memories, and we tend to, you know, reset our appetites even a notch or two higher than before. The one thing that I think is different this time, and you mentioned this earlier, is sort of a growing awareness about the environment and the fact that, you know, even if economically we end up in a better situation a few years from now, we actually live in a world of limited resources. And I think that is driving a higher consciousness among people that we need to rethink how we are using those resources. And a lot of that comes down to how we buy, what we buy, how often we buy, trying, you know, to recycle more, not necessarily giving into the kind of disposability, the kind of disposable culture that we seem to find ourselves in. So I think that's the thing that might actually create some long-term change in the way we think about frugality and thrift and consumption.
And is there a generation gap on this, or do you find the kind of attitudes about saving and spending to be just sort of evenly distributed, and it's not necessarily the case that older people are more conservative about this?
No, I don't really see a big gap on this. And I asked my psychologist great aunt, who I had talked about my father about this, and she said she had grown up during the Depression, and she said she knew people from that era who, you know, as they got older, said, I never want to feel deprived again, and were more than happy to spend lots of money. So it's always really hard to generalize about how an experience affects people. You find this, you know, across the spectrum. But that said, I do think, you know, partly because of the environmental awareness among people of maybe my generation, I'm 39, you know, people of my generation and younger, you know, I think that maybe there is a different sense that, you know, the consumption that we might have seen from our parents or baby boomer generation, that maybe the answers don't lie there. Maybe we need to find a middle way.
Our guest this morning, Lauren Weber. The book is In Cheap We Trust, The Story of a Misunderstood American Virtue. It's now published in paper by Back Bay Books. That's a division of Little Brown and the company. Lauren Weber was a staff reporter at Reuters and Newsday. She's also written for the New York Times, LA Times, other publications. And Ms. Weber, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now located at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop specializes in the sales and rental of band and orchestra instruments, digital keyboards, guitars, amps, and drums, along with a wide variety of sheet music.
We're here at the midpoint of Focus. We'll take a break as we usually do. Right now, we have an update for you on the markets. And with those numbers, here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, David, and good morning, everyone. As we're coming into the mid-session of the Chicago Board of Trade and we look at futures prices, we see that corn is in a downward side for the most part today. Soybeans, a mixed affair, and in the wheat futures, some strength shown in Kansas City, some weakness in Chicago. Let's look at particulars. In Kansas City, the summer wheat at 751 and a quarter up one. The March at 771 is up one. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trades at 701 and a half, down one. March 742 and three quarters, up a quarter. December corn, 576 and a quarter, down one. March, 590, down a half. May, 595 and a half, down three quarters. July, 598, down three quarters. September's 561 and a half, and it is up a quarter. November soybeans is at 1224, down one and a quarter. January, 1233 and a half, down one and a half. March, 1240, unchanged. July, 1251, up six and a quarter. December soybean meal at 336.90 is down 90 cents.